Thank you. I am Marilyn, and I'm an alcoholic, and I'm embarrassed by that generous introduction, starting with calling me a lady, which is kind of unusual for a person like me. but anyway, I'm really happy, so happy to be here. And was at a retreat earlier today, and a lot was talked about, a lot of things about the program. I remember many comments on character defects and the mysterious steps 6 and 7, and also the idea of acceptance, just the acceptance of reality. So I was thinking about that in terms of what it was like and what it's like today. This idea of acceptance, I had such a problem accepting that I had a ticket to Alcoholics Anonymous. We only have one requirement, and that's a desire to stop drinking or admission that we're powerless over alcohol. But I didn't have that ticket for a long time. And it was largely just because of an inability to accept reality. I was kind of wandering through life, always unhappy, and that in turn was due to character defects. And I didn't know that until years into sobriety, that I was the cause of my unhappiness. I just had one goal in mind, and I wanted to be a scientist. And I thought if I could be a scientist, then I'd be a happy person. And it never occurred to me that there were other people on earth, not even my own family. They were agents there to serve me and to help me do what I wanted to do and give me what I wanted to have right now. So I was not kind to other people. And dismissed them at best, was a little bit cruel at worst. Well, maybe that wasn't worst, but that was one of the bad things. And so I was just getting through life in that way. And I had a saintly mother who saved money so I could go away to study science. And I went off to a good school in Chicago. And I really wanted to get out of Ohio. I just did not like Ohio. And I think it was because of all the happy people there. There were even contented cows. Everybody was contented and happy. And that's because they lived by AA principles without even knowing what they were. I look back on that time. I mean, they'd go next door and introduce themselves to a new neighbor. They'd visit people who were sick in the hospital. And I could never figure out why people would waste their time doing something for others. Just altogether selfish and self-centered. So anyway, as I said, I was a miserable person. And then I thought, once I get to Chicago, then I'll be a happy person. Well, Chicago was like Ohio, but colder. And the first time I got there on a train, I got off the train and there was a conductor or a train worker dancing up and down, clearly very happy. He said, it's going to warm up today. It's going to get up to zero. I thought, a time to worry. So, as I say, it was like Ohio, but colder. And I clearly wanted to be a scientist and began to study science and had to get a job because my family was poor. I had a mother, but my dad was in the hospital for 12 years in a vegetative state. And she was the sole breadwinner. And as I said, just altogether unselfish and saintly. And in spite of terrible, terrible tragedy and poverty, she saved money for me. But it wasn't very much, so I had to get a job. And I went to one of the institutes there and had to take a little test to see if I could get a job. And it was a physics institute, the Fermi Institute. And I had to take a test involving a microscope, and this tall, pale guy came out to give me the test. And, oh my gosh, he was wearing a white lab coat, and he had a slide rule in his pocket. I mean, that's an old-fashioned calculator. And, oh, I just looked at him, and, well, I wanted to grab and fondle his slide rule, because that just spelled science. And I got that job, by the way, and started working there. And that was Bill, my scientist. And somehow, when I first saw him, I just thought, you are the one. I didn't know quite what one I meant, but it was yes. we are somehow linked. And just to leap way ahead, we were, and I don't know what that's all about, but I just knew instantly that he was the one. And we were together for over 60 years. We were married for 60 years. He passed away last year. So he really was the one. And I think we'll meet again and travel again together somewhere, sometime, in some other way. But back at that time, I was just fell in love with the magic of it, of science. And so we began to get acquainted. And Bill went off to a meeting in Washington, D.C., and he sent me a postcard. And it said, "Dear Marilyn, all I could come up with about what we were talking about is," and then he wrote out this beautiful, elegant partial differential equation. And, oh, my gosh, no man had ever talked to me like that before. And this was so magic. Sometimes people say, "Did that really happen?" Well, it did. I have that postcard in a red velvet box up in the closet. And sometimes I look at it and think, yep, it really did happen, didn't it? Lo, these many years ago. And so anyway, we were working there together, and Bill was way ahead of me. He was 8 years older, and he was finishing his education as I was beginning mine. But nevertheless, we just had some kind of instant bond. And he took a job in Los Angeles, and before he left, I said to him, "I think we should just end this now because it will break my heart when you leave." And he said, "Maybe I'll take you with me." And that was the beginning of this lifetime together. And we got married at a little church in his hometown. And his dad was a Lutheran minister. Now, Bill and I were both atheists, but his dad was a man of the cloth and performed the ceremony. So we heard those words, "for better, for worse, in sickness and in health." And Bill said, "I do." He should have seen in big, bold letters, "sickness and health, better or worse," in all caps. But he said, "I do." And he was a noble kind of guy, believed in keeping a commitment, and had no idea what he was agreeing to, clearly. And I heard those same words, and I thought, I'll say "I do," and that gives me permission to attach to you like a tick on a dog and suck out your life, which I proceeded to do. We did move to Los Angeles, and as you can well imagine, having some years in the program, that kind of thing is not a healthy relationship. It's bound to bring misery to both, which it did. And luckily, Bill had a program, and that was particle physics. He was a professor, physics professor, and found great, great satisfaction in that profession and pretty much ignored me. He had a healthy attitude. If he was around a broken machine, he'd either fix it or work around it. And he couldn't fix me, so he just worked around me. And it gave him, I think, enough peace of mind not to have gone crazy. But a lot of it was due to a profession that he loved very much. Meanwhile, I was growing ever more miserable as a result of the way I was living. Just taking unfair advantage of lots of people. I do for me. What's mine is mine. What's yours is clearly negotiable. You know, just that attitude about all things. And, but I was, by that time, a graduate student and had been invited into a nice lab. And all of my life, I thought, if I could be a scientist, then I'd be a happy person. And here I was. I was a scientist. I had my own white lab coat. I had my own slide rule now. I had a set of reagents. I was working on a biochemistry physiology project, muscle protein and how muscles work. Had a wonderful director, was in a wonderful lab, and still loved science in some kind of way. But all of a sudden, I realized I have gotten to that place where I should be a happy person. And I was miserable. I felt like a fraud. And I felt that the other people were talking about me behind my back and that nobody liked me and they saw through me. I felt that this is kind of nice, but it's not what I thought it would be. Now, there's terrible things that happen to alcoholics, and an alcoholic like me, one of the worst things is not getting instant gratification, not getting just what I always wanted. But something far worse I discovered was getting just what I always wanted and realizing, no, that's not it. And that's where I was, and that was in the 60s, and that's a scary thing because I lost hope at that point. As long as I knew there was something up ahead that would make me a happy person, then I lived in the future. When I get there, I'll be happy. Now I was in the future had come to pass. I was in it and pretty discontented. So then what do you do? Well, luckily, I found a new higher power. My higher power, my guiding force, of course, had been science. But now it was replaced by something so much more powerful. And this is a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I bet you can guess what that was. Yes, it was alcohol. It was everywhere in the 60s. It was on the lab shelf, ethanol, 90% ethanol. That's a 180 proof drink, mighty good. And so we could drink there, drink that. I mean, you're not supposed to drink it. You're supposed to use it for research. So several of us were doing research with it. It's the effect of alcohol on the human personality. And it was a good effect. And so we drank a lot of that up and ordered more. And then we'd go out to bars at night. And I then moved into that phase where I thought, it was science after all. I finally got just what I always wanted, and I'm a happy person. I am a real scientist now. When I drank, I no longer felt like a fraud. I felt like I'm the real deal, and I'm probably going to win the Nobel Prize the next time it's announced. It was just a wonderful, wonderful time. Whereas before, I didn't know how to talk to my lab mates or anybody else. I'd go to parties with my husband, and I didn't know what to say. It was this horrible kind of conversation where somebody would say, how are you? And that would baffle me. I mean, how do you answer a question like that? I'd try to tell them about my depressions and anxiety, and they would ease away and form another little group of two or three people. And I mean, I couldn't deal with society, with social interaction. Whereas now that I had alcohol, I was at home in any kind of a crowd. I went to parties with my husband, and now I had a good time. I remember one of them was a Halloween party, and everybody was in costume. I had a harlequin costume with bright orange pants and one of those hats with dangling things with bells on it, and just having a good old time, and they were serving all kinds of wonderful things, Manhattans and gimlets and Gibsons and just these exotic names, and I was downing all of them, and I noticed the chairman of Bill's department, and I thought, I've got to go over and talk to him to help out my husband and make a good impression, and that way that'll help Bill. And so anyway, I went over and introduced myself to the chairman and made sure that he knew that I was Bill's wife, and he said, oh, yes, a new member of the department. Oh, yes, I've got to get acquainted with him. And so I thought, well, I will impress you with my knowledge of science. Well, I was studying biology, and somehow I fell upon the sex life of crustaceans as a thing to talk to him about. And as I was standing there finishing one drink, I noticed somehow I was wetting my pants. Those bright orange harlequin pants. Oh, my God. And then it was forming a little puddle on the floor. And the chairman just kind of backed away, turned, and eased out of the room. And I was just standing there in that puddle. What do you do? I hate when that happens. So I ran out the French doors, and I was in the backyard, and I thought, I've got to get out of here. Maybe I can just run all the way home. But there was a 6-foot cinder block wall, which I knew I couldn't scale. And so I just stood there wondering, what do I do? What do I do? And I noticed there was a playpen in the yard, and there was a dachshund in the playpen. And that thing was kind of yipping away, making some sad noises. And I thought, that dog sounds as miserable as I am. So I went over to comfort the dog, and so I knelt down and put my hand to pet the poor creature's head, And instead of petting his head, he opened his mouth and his jaws clamped down on my hand. And I pulled my hand out and pulled the skin way back. And there I was with blood dripping down my hand and thought, well, I better go in. So I walked back in the house. And it is the luck of the alcoholic that that happened, because nobody noticed my wet pants. They were just staring at this hand dripping blood all over the floor. And I was rushed off to emergency, and I was saved to save hideous embarrassment. And these were the fun days. Wonderful. And I was just having a good time then. And that went on for a couple of years. As I said, I felt like I'm just really living well, doing wonderful things. I was even happy at home, drank a lot of beer at home. Beer had become my favorite drink, and I drank it all the time, or anything else that was around, as long as I had alcohol in it. And after a few years, the director of the lab asked me to write up my project. I've tried to remember what my project was. It was something about muscle protein, and I couldn't think of anything I had really accomplished on that research project that had been funded for two or three years. I had nothing to show for it. And at that point, my relationship with alcohol changed entirely. It was a time of terrible, terrible panic. I went home and just sat there on the couch trying to think of, what do I do now? My coping skills were like zero. And now alcohol was that friend in terror, deep and terrible fear. What do I do now? And I couldn't think of anything to do, anything useful. So I just mailed the keys back after some amount of time, weeks. And now alcohol, still my higher power, was a different kind of friend. It was a friend in utter despair. I had lost my career. I was miserable. I was alone. I just did not know how to get out of this terrible situation I was in. Well, the situation grew much more dire because I began to give birth to lots of little children. It seemed like there were so many, but later in sobriety, I realized there's only three, just three. And I had no coping skills to begin with, but now I was a mother with these little children to be responsible for that kept multiplying. Well, I mean, they weren't multiplying. I was multiplying. And I just have vague memories of infants and toddlers. And one time I was holding an infant on my lap, and Paul Harvey was on the radio screaming at the top of his, that's an old newscaster. Some of you look young, you probably never heard of Paul Harvey, but he was a popular newscaster with this staccato voice. And he was saying, women, alcoholics, go down faster than men. There's about 10 years between that first drink and institutions. Then he went on to a commercial, but I had gotten up to turn off that terrible noise. And I was holding an infant. And as I said, these were blackout, brownout years. And I don't even remember which one it was, whether it was the baby or but I remember that distinctly, thinking, I've got to cushion his or her little head. That was how I was a good mom, by not crashing that little head into the wall as I careened off the walls to get to the radio. And that was being a good mom, protecting that little head. I didn't get to the radio in time. I heard the whole message, and I started counting. But meanwhile, my husband had noticed that things had gone to hell in a handbasket. I think a couple of times he came home, and I wasn't at home. I was out getting more to drink. And that struck the real fear into Bill, who didn't react emotionally too much. But that was really, really scary. And he very quickly, being a man of science, and if he could fix a situation, he would. If he couldn't, he worked around it. Well, he could fix that situation. He just brought his mother in to live with us, my mother-in-law, and she took care of the situation. She took care of the children. She would sometimes bring food out to me out in the garage. I'd sort of moved into the garage because it was clear that when I was in the house, I'd get lectures from her. And she was just giving me encouragement. Somehow she knew about Alcoholics Anonymous, and she often talked to me about AA and just things like, unless you straighten up and stop drinking, we're going to lock you up and you'll never see the children again. You better go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that did not give me a good impression of Alcoholics Anonymous. I just associated it with my mother-in-law. I imagine I'd go there and there'd be a room full of mother-in-laws. And so I resisted that, but she kept applying the heat. And I visited AA in 1969, but it didn't take. I didn't have that ticket that I described before, the desire to stop drinking. I just wanted mother-in-law to go home. I did not think I was powerless over alcohol at that point. So, of course, I mean, people tolerated me. If you walk in and say you're an alcoholic, they believe you, but I didn't believe it in my heart. After a while, I left. Before I left, there was a couple of people that I saw. People kept taking me into this big active group, the Pacific Group, the founder, Clancy Emmislin. We, on the West Coast, we use a last name if someone has passed on, and we lost Clancy on August 24th. But he was the founder of that group that people seemed to want to take me into. They'd say things like, Marilyn, you're so intense. We know a group that's just right for you. So I was taken into the Pacific Group, and here was Clancy, bigger than life, just seemed to have control of the situation. He, in those days, reminded me of my mother-in-law, I'll tell you, because he was scary. He scared me, and I didn't like authority anyway, and he was definitely an authority. Just to leap ahead so you don't get the wrong impression, when I was 18 years sober, Clancy became my sponsor. And he was my sponsor for 30 years before he passed away last month. So I came to appreciate that authority and love that man. But back in those days, as I said, he was just scary authority. But there was somebody who was softer, and that was the wonderful Marianne Wallin. And yet I never talked to her because I was waiting for her to come over and talk to me. And she didn't do that. So I just stood in the back and watched, but she had people coming up to her. They clearly loved her, and she had a sense of purpose that was clear, a good sense of humor. I studied her, and I was just waiting for that day she would come over and introduce herself and say, I want to get to know you. I'd like to be your sponsor. You'd soon become my favorite. And she never did that, so I never got to know her. What I did was I just left the fellowship, went home and drank my worst years of drinking for 2 or 3 years. Of course, mother-in-law moved back in. And in February 1972, I called Central Office, and that's the office in Los Angeles. And they sent somebody to get me, and that was the wonderful Lorena, who is sober to this day in a little town called Ojai, still being of service, well over 50 years of sobriety. And she was the first really, really good example of service. And she came, and she was so different from my mother-in-law. She talked about a terrible life that she had led with lots of drinking. And as I listened to that, I almost began to weep because it was such a sad story. And I felt terribly sorry for her. And then she got real happy and began to say that her life is not like that now, and that she and her husband made peace with each other, and they have a happy family. She loves her life. She's gotten interested in all these wonderful new things, and it's all because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she's going to take me to a meeting. Well, I didn't think I wanted to do that, but it was nice to have her visit. But she stayed, and it was clear she was going to do that. Now, I have many character defects, but one I didn't hint at, I told you about it. Just any warm mammal that comes along, preferably a human, I just attach to you and begin to drain out, just eat your soul. And along with that kind of sick dependency goes a need to please you. I want you to like me. Please, please like me. I'll do anything. I'll tell you all kinds of lies, but just express your approval. And already I wanted Lorena to like me, so I knew I had to go to that meeting with her. And off we went, and it was dark and quiet, as she had promised. And I went to sleep in the first half and then woke up at the coffee break and was waiting to get back to sleep. And the leader came back to the podium and said, "Tonight, our main speaker is Marion W." And there was my beautiful Marion standing at the podium. And I, as I said, I was an atheist, but I had studied science and I knew about probability. And I just saw that bell-shaped curve that we talk about standard deviations and averages and things. And I just knew that that happening was way out, about 6 standard deviations out from normal. I mean, how could that happen with all the possible meetings in Los Angeles and all the possible speakers that somehow Marion would be the one person I wanted to meet in Alcoholics Anonymous, and she was the speaker at that meeting. Now, to this day, I have no idea how that happened. I chalk it up to some kind of weird and wonderful coincidence, but there have been many coincidences. My friend Diana says, I guess she's quoting Yogi Berra, but it's too much of a coincidence to be a coincidence. And that was. Now I've come to suspect something else, a kind of orchestration that happens in this fellowship that works toward our recovery. But it's so complex that I can't imagine, I can't possibly imagine how that kind of thing occurs. But I do know that that was one in a long series of events that has led to recovery for me in this fellowship. So, of course, I listened to her. I heard my story told by Marion, fierce dependencies on people, especially her husband, and fear, a lot of fear. And after the meeting, I ran up and I said, "Would you be my sponsor?" And she agreed to be my sponsor if I would come to her home group, which was, you guessed it, the Pacific group. Okay, anything, Marion. I didn't. That's one of those instances. I stood at the turning point. I could have said, "No, Marion, I think I'm going to do it my way. I want dark, quiet meetings," which I really did want. But somehow I was so beaten down by alcohol, again, so hopeless, in such despair, so desperate, that I said, okay, even that. I had come to believe that my ideas probably are just not very good. And maybe this thing that they talk about in AA, get a sponsor, get a home group, maybe I should give that a try. And besides, I'd already attached to Marion and I was not going to let her go. And she brought me into Alcoholics Anonymous and introduced me to this great big active group, the Pacific group. And Clancy was still there, again, even larger than life. And there were so many activities. I got so tired in those first years. Go to 7 meetings a week, take a job at every meeting, go to Clancy's backyard on Saturday, play team sports. I'm not a team player. They didn't believe me. Jump in and do it with lots of laughter at me. Move furniture on Sunday. There was always somebody moving from place to place. And so we'd all form a fireman's brigade and move people's furniture. And then there was some kind of wedding or AA birthday party in the afternoon. We'd go to meetings every night. And the Saturday night meeting, we'd celebrate birthday parties there. 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, and 10 years. Nobody was sober more than 10 years in those days, except Clancy. And Clancy would have a stay after the meeting, and then he'd sit at an old rickety piano there at the meeting hall and play old barroom songs. And he could play by ear, and he'd play all these old songs, and we'd sing at the piano. But we couldn't go home after that. We'd go to somebody's restaurant. And there was usually somebody turning one, and we'd have a watch. We'd watch them and keep them sober until midnight so they couldn't possibly break free and go out and drink. We'd watch them, and that was the watch. And we watched until midnight and all sang happy birthday, and then we'd get to go home and sleep a little bit. Well, I was pretty sleepless in those first years, but I'll tell you, that kind of activity wore me out so much that soon I began to start sleeping when I'd get to bed and then start again the next day. Of course, Marion introduced me to the whole deal. We have these three legacies, unity, recovery, service, you know, fellowship, and be of service. But recovery, the recovery part were these steps. And of course I got into the steps. Everybody else was doing them, so I had to do them too. But I was wary of the ones that mentioned God. I explained to her I'm an atheist, and she explained to me that it doesn't say you have to believe in some kind of God that's constructed by other people. It's God as you understand God. It can be me, she said, your sponsor for a while. Just do what I say. Trust. And she kind of laughed about that, but that's what I was doing. She was my higher power, my goddess of sobriety. And it served me well. I was doing everything for her approval, and it caused me to take those good actions that were ones I needed for recovery. She said, it can be your home group. It can be anything, just something that's more powerful than you. And so I could accept that. One time I said to a friend, because I was altogether hung up about this idea of God, I was telling him that I didn't really know how to pray because I didn't believe in some kind of supernatural God, and clearly everybody else did. So I would say a prayer, and it was force in the universe that somehow made it possible for Marion to be the main speaker at that meeting I was taken back to. While everybody else was saying the Lord's Prayer or the Serenity Prayer, I'd say that one. And we could all end on the same time, and I'd say Amen. And one time I was telling my friend John Lockie, who was 40-plus years sober at that time, an old-timer and has long since passed, wonderful man, and he was very kind to me. And so I thought, I'll be honest with him. And I told him that story of what I said while everybody else was praying. And I said, you know, they think I'm saying those prayers, but they don't know. I'm just saying what I can believe in and then saying Amen. And I kind of laughed at what I was putting over on everybody. And he said, so you're just saying you're praying to whatever makes sense to you. I said, yeah, that's it. While everybody else is praying to God. And he said, Marilyn, I hate to break this to you, but that's exactly what we're all doing. God as we understand God. And then he laughed really loudly. And then he went on to say, your thoughts are your prayers. And your religion is your life. Now, my thoughts were self-obsession in those days, so I was praying to myself most of the time. But when he said that, it made me think, and I began to clean up my thoughts a little bit. I began to substitute other thoughts now and then, realizing what he had said. And now my religion was my life, and that was the life given to me by Alcoholics Anonymous. So I was on a spiritual path. But I really envied people like the great Chuck Chamberlain. He talked about God in this personal way. He's the pappy, and we're his kids. And they just laugh this funny little tee-hee-hee. And at first I just thought, gosh, what a corny old man. But then I began to look at him, and he radiated. He walked into a room, and the whole room got brighter. And he had just had this beautiful smile. And I think that there was some kind of presence that came into the room with him that I envied. I wanted to know what he knew. It was something really, really big. And one time I was all alone, and I just said, coming to believe that there may be something way beyond what I had ever imagined, maybe this thing that people seem to think is God, something transcendental, might be there. So I just said to it, if you're there, I want to get to know you, and if you're really there, I'm willing to go on any path I pick for you. And my heart beat fast because I realized I'd signed a big contract, but what I didn't realize until years later was that I'd already been transformed because I could make that prayer. In other words, I wanted what God wanted for me. That's kind of the third step and seventh step prayers rolled into one for me. Take all of me, put me on the path you want me to be on, and I want to get to know you. And what happened was not what I wanted, which was something like in the movies, you know, loud music, angels, lights, nothing. But for about 3 years, I was taking the steps, and in approaching my third birthday, I was in a lot of psychic pain, which just meant that I had come into contact with real feelings, stuff that I'd repressed all those years as a result of these steps was coming to the surface. And that step 6 and 7 happening without me being able to control it, God reaching in and looking at those psychic bones that had been set the wrong way, breaking them and then putting them back together in some kind of way with less stress on my personality. Dropping that rock, as Sandy Beach used to say, dropping that rock of all these, being willing to let go of all this stuff that kept me from you. Ah. I am sorry, that was an alarm that was going off. I had to control that. So, back to year 3. So I was in a lot of psychic pain because that kind of process of upwelling of all of these emotions, steps 6 and 7, often produce a lot of psychic pain, and a lot of it was coming all at once for me. And around my third AA birthday, I just felt that I am in such psychic pain, kind of a dark night of the soul, that I was just screaming out into the ether, I want out. I mean, I wanted to die from the kind of pain that I was experiencing. I don't like pain. I want out. And suddenly the veil parted and I came into contact with a God of my very own. Now that's the sudden kind of spiritual experience. And I went from atheism to knowing pretty rapidly. And our book talks about the other, which is the educational variety. And most of my friends, in fact, my closest friend, Diana, that I have known all through the length of my sobriety, has had this steady awakening and another, just of the educational variety, which means one epiphany after another until one day you know, you just know. But mine was fairly sudden. And it stood me in good stead ever since. And I needed that. I needed that for the years that followed. Because having taken the steps, I was taken out into real life. And I'd made amends to the director of the lab where I'd drunk all that alcohol, in the lab alcohol, beer, everything, and had so disgraced myself. I tried to make amends, but it was really just an apology. But after a few years, he called and invited me back into the lab to work there again. In a moment of insanity, I'm sure, but for some reason he offered me a job, and I'm sure it was because I made amends to him. How would he remember? And the biggest amends, of course, were to my family, writing a letter to my mother-in-law, apologizing, which caused her to write a letter to me, apologizing for her part. She's a normal person. And that allowed us to have a relationship. And why that was important was because it allowed our 3 kids to have a grandma. And also I made amends to my own mother, whom I had just heaped abuse on, because she came to stay some of those times when I was so sick. And so I had a lifetime of amends. Luckily, those 2 mothers, mother-in-law and my mother, lived to be about 100 years old. And I think that was a gift from God, because I'm slow. So I had a lifetime of amends, really many, many years, and I'm grateful for all of them. As I said, I went back to work and went back to school, in fact, and finished the degrees that I had not finished while I was drinking, when I crashed and burned, and got out of the lab. I don't enjoy, nor am I adept at wet science, but I went into medical informatics, working with databases and computers and scientific information. And in later years, I did a lot of teaching, either informatics or science, and have been a part of a lifelong learning institute where people who retire want to learn stuff they had never studied before. And so I teach science courses there to people like maybe attorneys or humanists or somebody who just want to learn a little bit about the universe and immune system and whatnot. So that has been great fun. But when I was 18 years sober, I had gotten out into the real world and things were going so well. I did what's sometimes easy for alcoholics. I began to imagine that, you know, I'm pretty well now. Thank God I didn't realize that I was well enough to have a drink. But I was approaching that by getting another higher power, and that was work. And just throwing myself into that, making something of myself, using the program in a way that is not intended, and that was to make my life better, to get the things that make me comfortable, get a better job, a little more money, we can buy nicer things, nicer car, fix up the house, need a more prestigious position at work, I'll work for that. That was becoming a higher power work. That is very easy for me to get into. And a lot of those character defects that I thought had been taken away in dropping the rock, I realized they were just put into a closet, this character defects closet. And they come creeping out, strangely. And so then I have to think about steps 6 and 7 again. But at those, in those times, I was just kind of indulging those character defects, like envy of other people at work, like pride in what I did, like telling lies to people if I felt that that might make them like me better. All those, they kept creeping out, and I was feeling discontented again because, I mean, we take steps 6 and 7 not out of some kind of goodness to the universe, but so that we feel better. I just didn't understand that for a long time. Character defects make us feel bad. And so, and they were making me feel bad again. And I'd gone to Israel, because little daughter Susie had lived on a kibbutz there for half a year, and I joined her. And while I was there, somehow it hit me. And I don't know why Israel, but God often chooses Israel to do some big thing. I mean, think about it. Three major religions started there. I mean, what happened to me was nothing approaching anything like that. But nevertheless, I was standing right next to the Sea of Galilee, looking at that, looking at Susie standing on a rock, and the wind was blowing through her hair. And I loved her. And I realized that I've been missing out because I've stopped loving people. I've stopped serving people. I have lived a pretty selfish life in these last years, and I just apologized to God, and I said one more time, please, I'm here. I know you're there, but please use me. I'm sorry. I'm sorry for just kind of corrupting my program in that way. And I thought that I had to go to Calcutta and turn myself over to Mother Teresa, but when we came back to the States, people on the program explained it's not that. Maybe it's just deeper involvement in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's when I threw myself back into the Pacific group in a big way, and Clancy became my sponsor at 18 years of sobriety. And it's my conviction that I can't make myself be of use to anybody or anything. I'm much too slothful. But by turning myself over to a vehicle like the Pacific Group, which is constantly asking you to do stuff, put me to use. I just had to be available and say yes. Now, we can't say no to an AA request. I mean, that we learned when we're tiny in the fellowship. And so I was put to use. I began to sponsor a bunch of women and go to lots of meetings and do some speaking and participate in panels. And it just became a life of full joy. I think some of my character defects even went back into the closet, because in listening to them do their 10th steps and their inventories, I faced up to my own, and I began to realize, yep, I got to work on that again. I got to get honest again. I've got to not be lazy, no procrastination. And having Clancy as a sponsor was such an inspiration, because nobody could keep up with that man. And I loved having a sponsor like that, setting that good, good, good example. I mean, whenever I would call and say, do I really have to go to Lake Arrowhead on a Friday night through downtown traffic and drive up a mountain? And he'd say, well, I'd like to talk to you, but I got to catch a plane for Newfoundland, where doing quite a few talks up there. Yeah, I guess I'm going to Lake Arrowhead on Friday. So that was life with Clancy. And another thing about Clancy was that it was always a lot of fun to be in a room with Clancy. He told jokes. He played the piano. It was just life. It's showing that it is safe to be super active, because he clearly had so many people who adored and loved him, and he had so much joy in his life. And that's how I've lived in Alcoholics Anonymous by example. So that's been a bigger impression on me than what people say, is what they do and how they seem as a result. I needed Clancy. I needed my higher power, because when I was 40 years old, sober, I was speaking at State Line, and I had watched our kids grow up, and they were all having wonderful, happy families and happy careers, and I was so proud of them again, pride, sort of feeling sorry for other families who had problems with their children, pride, and not realizing that, yep, that's one of those defects. Well, what happened was that after I left the podium on Friday night, we got word that our beautiful, beloved son, David, had hanged himself in his office. And my world fell apart. I was 40 years sober, and I needed every year of that. I called Clancy, and he was speaking at the same convention, State Line, and woke him up, and he was grumpy. And then I told him what I was calling for. And it's like Superman going into the telephone booth. He rips off outer clothing, and there's the Superman costume. Clancy just immediately became sponsor, super sponsor, and got into it. And he just began to say, you have 40 years of sobriety. You can do this. Your husband is alone at home in Los Angeles without a program to comfort him. Nobody there. You must go home and be his strength. You must be strength for the rest of the family. And when he talked to me like that, that was a hypnotic suggestion. I got in the car and drove across the desert for 5 hours. And there was Bill, a shattered man. And we began to put our family back together. But I was sustained on that ride home. I had a CD in the car to listen to, and it was the wonderful Sandy Beach, who had lost two daughters the year before. One to our disease, the other was murdered in her yard. And there's a television show about that right now going on. Murder on Middle Beach, I think it's called. But at that time, there was this one CD that I could listen to, and Sandy Beach was talking about how he coped with that situation. And he just said, you go out to your higher power before you react deeply to it. You'll have time and form that bond again, stronger than ever. And when you do begin to react, guess who comes back with you? And I can tell you that that is true. And my higher power was with me, and the Pacific group was with me. My sponsees were with me, and I was carried through that time. I was told by Julie St. J., that who had lost her son 10 years before, that if I can accept acceptance, then I'll find that there are blessings. Many blessings will come into my life. And I thought, I can't accept this. Well, I never did, as you would say, accept it as being a good thing. But I did accept her words, and I began to accept life. And I realized, as time went by, that I, for years, had been in a mode of acceptance. I will accept as long as I agree with it. I will accept reality as long as I approve of it. That's all I need. But if it's bad, that's another story. Well, she meant accept the good and the bad. The seemingly good and the seemingly bad is something essential for my growth. And I have come to integrate that into my life. And it is a wound, but it is now just a scar. And I do have a gift, and that is that when I talk at a meeting, there's usually somebody that comes through the line who's experiencing such a thing. And I can say, come into this circle. It is safe. You will survive. You will one day pull people into the circle. But in the meantime, here's my phone number. Let's talk for a while. And like our promises say, that we will not regret the past. We will find that this is just grist for our recovery mill. We give our experience to others, and they know whether it's genuine. They know whether you have lived through that. And I have an experience I would not have wanted to have, but it does give me the ticket to talk to them, and it's convincing. And that is a great gift that we give to one another. It's been almost 10 years since that happened. I returned to teaching. In fact, I was elected president of that institute for, it's a 2-year commitment. So I was kept really, really busy with activities in AA and in this place where I was teaching. And our family knitted back together, and we began to have happy times again, happy memories of David. Life went on. And in this last year, I lost Bill and I lost Clancy, but it was such a different experience because they lived long and wonderful lives. And we said goodbye with full knowledge that we'd meet up on the other side. I'm old. I'm very old. And for those of you who are younger, everybody in the room, I'm sure, it's safe. I love life now. Very blessed with it. And I live accepting life in a comfortable way most of the time. But I look forward to that next step, too. I'm sure it's going to be exciting and wonderful. And I will see Clancy. I will see Bill. I will see a lot of these people that we have loved and said goodbye to in past years. Marianne will be there. And that will be exciting. I think that all of this is such a gift. But I think the greatest gift is this idea of finally I got just what I always wanted. You would say, what is it? Oh, I said, I don't quite know. I just know that I got it. That's the feeling of having got just what I always wanted. And I thank you for it, all of you. Thank you.